Welcome to Angry Americans. Welcome to episode 8. I'm your host, Paul Rykoff. If you've been with me throughout this season so far, you know it's been a journey. We're on the road together through some of the most perilous times in American history. We've ridden into issues that have folks angry nationwide, from electric scooters to public bathrooms to measles. We dug into the shocking rate of maternal death in America, the courageous fights of our heroic 9/11 first responders to get the care they deserve, and a possible war with Iran. I've rolled through the streets of America to hear from real people to see what they're pissed off about. The working people of America, people who don't have a congressional seat, a cable news show, or a podcast. Even in just the first couple months of this show, we're rolling together through some of the craziest times in politics our country's ever seen. And many of you have shared your thoughts on social media using the hashtag Angry Americans, and I appreciate it and I hear you. We've also had some extremely interesting folks along for that ride with us, from Willie Geist to 9/11 hero Rob Serra, Ron Perlman from Sons of Anarchy, Peter Berg, Sarah Jessica Parker, Ajin Poo, Rachel Maddow. They've all shared their thoughts on the troubling state of affairs in America, and they've also shared where they come from, how they got to where they are, what inspires them, and what color peeps they like most. We've talked about whiskey, and we've heard about their first cars. And like our great American experiment, our journey together across this country in these strange and important times has had some surprises, some great views, and some potholes. But we're continuing to move forward. We're driving on. And for this episode, for Memorial Day weekend, maybe you're on a long drive right now, off to somewhere cool, listening to this podcast. Or maybe you're chilling on the beach, or getting ready for a family barbecue, or for your city pool to open up. Or maybe you're at work, listening to this show in pieces on your coffee break. And maybe you're deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, as our country continues to teeter on the edge of war with neighboring Iran. Look, no matter where you are, no matter what color you are, or how much money you do or don't have, we're all in this together. And this show is a place for us all to learn, laugh, process, protest, together. And in this episode, I'm going to try to again bring you a topic that's incredibly urgent, one that's got me angry and should have everyone angry. At the end of the show, I've got a simple, important, timely, angry action for you. A place to direct your energy, specific to the summer and Memorial Day. And I've got a very special interview with another fantastic American, Tom Colicchio. Tom's a friend of mine that I met in my journeys as an activist who, like all my other guests, is an important, iconic, or inspiring American. You might know him from his massively successful TV show Top Chef, or his restaurants nationwide like Kraft, and one of my favorites in New York, Temple Court. He's one of the most famous chefs in America, and now in the world. He's written cookbooks. He's been the executive producer of a documentary called The Place at the Table. He's won the Outstanding Chef Award from the James Beard Foundation. He's won an Emmy. And what you may not know is that Tom's also a patriot and a dedicated activist. He's been a leader in pushing the incredibly and increasingly influential restaurant industry to do more. He served food in New York in the days after 9/11. He's fought for candidates and causes he cares about. And he's fighting hunger. He serves on two food relief organizations, the Food Council at City Harvest and the City Council at the Food Bank for New York City. And recently, at his restaurant Kraft in New York, he invited one of the Top Chef finalists, Chef Eric Ajapong, to present a full menu called The Transatlantic Slave Trade Through Food. It was a dinner that zigzagged around the world, retracing the forced migration of enslaved Africans and illuminating the lasting global culinary influences of the whole continent. It was the first in a series of dinners at Kraft that Tom's doing that highlight chefs with really strong culinary voices who don't have their own bricks and mortars restaurants. He's going to host dinners by a chef called Omar Tate, a Philadelphia guy who uses food to explore blackness in America. Another one by Gabriela Alvarez, who uses food to tell the story of Puerto Rico before and after Hurricane Maria. He's also an incredibly inspiring American success story. Tom started out in a working-class family in New Jersey, and he's risen to global recognition. He's a husband to an amazing wife, Lori, and three boys, and he's now the rare, and I think increasingly, thankfully, less rare example of an entrepreneur who's also a social entrepreneur. This episode is a break from the intensity of the last few weeks of politics in America, but it still matters deeply. Consider it food for thought. Definitely if you're a foodie, and maybe especially if you're not. As you head into a summer filled with food and politics, we'll bring both of them together for an in-depth conversation with a leader who's driving the future of America on food and politics and policy and much more. It's an episode of Angry Americans with the four courses that I promise you in every episode. An amuse-bouche of integrity, an appetizer of information, a main course of impact, and a dessert of inspiration. So turn up your speakers or set that cruise control, fire up your grill of curiosity, and warm up your deep fryer of learning, and let's dig into it. Welcome to Angry Americans, Episode 8. Okay, here's an issue that's got me angry, and I think should have everyone angry. Now look, with Trump president, I could pretty much do a daily show, just waking up every morning and thinking about what dumb crap he's done to make me angry and make the whole world angry. It's like a daily flood of stupidity and reckless selfishness. But this week, he really got me. Earlier this week, it was reported in the New York Times that Trump may be preparing pardons for service members accused of war crimes. This is something I actually have to talk to you about. I have to actually do a segment on my podcast covering the fact that the President of the United States is considering pardons for troops convicted of war crimes. This is really happening. He's had days to say, no, I do not support these war criminals. I will not pardon them, but he hasn't. He's left the door open, and now there are reports that he may wait till Memorial Day to announce that he's pardoned several American troops accused or convicted of war crimes. Now, this includes high profile cases of murder, attempted murder, and desecration of a corpse. One of them involves a case where a service member urinated on the corpse of a fallen enemy. That is a violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It is a violation of the Geneva Convention. It is a violation of good order and discipline. It is a violation of all that is sensible. Pardoning war criminals, I guess I have to say this, is terrible. It's a terrible idea for our democracy. It's a terrible idea for our military. It actually puts our troops in danger. Because if the world thinks that we are the bad guys, we're done. We're supposed to be the good guys. We are normally viewed as the good guys. But if the world finds out that our commander-in-chief is okay with war crimes, that's gone. Our troops are immediately in danger. They are not the good guys anymore. And our president gives them a pass to violate all the global standards for discipline, for honor, for integrity. There's also another element here that I think people don't fully understand. When the enemy thinks that they will be treated well, they give up more easily. If they think they're going to be tortured, if they think they're going to be murdered, if they think they're going to be urinated on when they're dead, they're going to fight till their dying breath. Knowing that Americans treat troops well is a strategic, tactical, military advantage to us. It makes the enemy give up more easily, which is good for troops, good for America, good for our military. You know, it's not good for troops, not good for America, not good for our military. Pardoning war criminals who have been convicted or accused in military courts. If you trust the military, if you respect the military, trust their rule of law, trust their courts, allow them to do their thing. Don't come flying in and throw a hand grenade into the entire military legal system because some dude on Fox News thinks it might make for a good bump in your poll ratings. This is an issue of the utmost outrage, the utmost seriousness. This would be an ethical, moral rock bottom. In an administration where you can't see the bottom, we keep going lower. This would be a new low. It would be catastrophic. It would be disrespectful, but it would not be surprising. Now, this is an issue that's got me angry, and I think should have everyone angry, because if you're not angry about this, you're really not paying attention. What do you think? Use the hashtag Angry Americans and sound off, because this one's really got me going, and I hope has your attention. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a really special treat today. I am thrilled and happy. It's a beautiful sunny day in New York, and we have the great Tom Colicchio joining us, my friend, an inspiration, an icon. Every week I try to talk to an iconic, important, inspiring American who's really had an impact on what it means to be American. And I've been really excited to talk to you, man. So thanks for coming in.
Of course, Paul. Yeah, this is pretty awesome. It is a beautiful day out here, I guess. You know, it all depends. The weather's beautiful, but in America right now, you know, things are getting tough. You have to sort of define what it means. You know, you said, what is to be American? You have to redefine it. We did a pop-up in my restaurant with a great young African-American chef named Omar Tate. And he talked about his family being here for 200 years. And so my family hasn't been here for 200 years. And then he talked about, he did this whole dinner around, everything on the plate, there was an intention behind it. And he was redefining what it means to be a Black American and wrapping himself in the flag while doing it. And it was actually pretty cool. So yeah, I think that right off the top, that is what's important right now. What is it to be American? And So let's get into it.
Yeah, and he's, I think, from Philly, right?
Yeah, he is.
I did a bit in the intro where I talked about this series you're doing in your restaurant, and, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of folks know you from TV, they know you from the cooking world, but right. I met you through the world of politics and advocacy.
Right, right.
And, you know, the first meeting we had was about issues.
Sure.
Right? And so can you talk a little bit about maybe that side of yourself and your work and your passion, like... I want to let you open up on that.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, as a working chef in New York for the last 30 plus years, we had always been asked, chefs are always asked, we're kind of like the first defenders, you know, the first responders when it comes to charitable events, because people know we show with food and good food. And mostly focused on hunger. I think that chefs, we're simpatico when it comes to organizations that are trying to alleviate hunger, because we feed people for a living, people that can afford it. But I think also I believe that food is a right, and everyone should have access to affordable, high quality, nutritious food. So we're always asked to do these events, and whether it was with Share Our Strength, No Kid Hungry, our Meals on Wheels, our God's Love We Deliver, our New York Food Bank. We were always there, and I remember years and years ago doing some media training around hunger, and I thought I knew a bit about it. And, you know, growing up, I grew up in Elizabeth, New Jersey. In fact, you know, we can look down the Hudson here, and I can kind of see where I grew up.
The Classic Car Club Manhattan. It's Fleet Week. The ships went by a couple hours ago. Uh-huh. All the Navy ships came by, but... Now, I'm interested to get into that too, man. I mean, you came from a really working class background.
Yeah, yeah. So
across the river now into this other world.
Yeah,
right?
My dad was a corrections officer. My mother ran a school lunch program when we were a little older. When we were kids, she was home. But so we knew that in our community, some of the kids were hungry, but the church would take care of it. And we kind of knew, and we just kind of, that's okay. But so the more time I spent as a chef in New York, obviously, helping to raise money, and I thought I was doing my part. And then my wife, Lori, who was mentoring a young woman who was living in a shelter at the time, And we would have her come to the house, and it was clear that she was hungry. It was also clear to us that she had some learning disabilities. And so in New York City, if the public school can't meet the needs of the kids, the city will pay for them to go to a private school. And this wasn't some big fancy private school, but there was a school that where they dealt with some learning disabilities. And so first couple weeks into the semester, we get a phone call. My wife got a phone call from the principal saying this woman's clearly hungry and asking people for food. Because it wasn't a public school, they didn't have a breakfast and lunch program. Mm. And so this young woman was not getting her breakfast and lunch at school. And so my wife came home and said, listen, she's a filmmaker and she does narrative film, but she thought that she should make a documentary about this issue, how in the richest country in the world, at the time it was over 50 million people were struggling putting food on the table, including 16 million children, including 13 million seniors, including, I think at the time, it was a high number of vets as well. And that's how we met, dealing with the hunger issue in the vet community. And so the film came out and it really gave me a soapbox to talk about these issues. And obviously I became more versed in the issues. And from that film, that led to me the co-founder of an organization called Food Policy Action, where we actually were lobbying Congress. We weren't getting paid to do this because poor people weren't paying us to lobby on behalf of hungry people. Yeah. But we also expanded that into farming and other issues as well. What we did is we published a scorecard. So we actually graded Congress on how they voted on these various food issues, including hunger. And it, 2 years in, we started to get people's attention.
Yeah.
3 years in, we would get angry phone calls from members saying, why was my score so low? And
which means you're doing your job.
Then we would get, well, if I knew someone was keeping score, I would have voted differently.
Right.
Great. That's exactly, that was our goal.
That's the behavior change you want.
Yeah.
Right?
So I worked with that organization for about 5 years and then I left recently. They're still doing great work. But that's it. When I started doing TV, I was known as a chef in New York for a long time. But once I started doing TV, I was known, all of a sudden the power of TV sort of put you in a different position.
Yeah.
And for me, it was like, how do I use that power for good? Yeah. How do I use the soapbox that I got to actually, work on issues and issues that I care about or that my friends care about? And how do I amplify that? Even just the fact that I have close to a million Twitter followers, all of a sudden it amplifies a message.
Right.
And so... So that's how I got more involved.
And you're known for being very observant and being very focused and being a very effective judge. So now to turn that bright light onto Congress.
Yeah.
I mean, not to diminish it, but how is it different when you're judging your craft and you see a very high level of proficiency and execution and planning and thoughtfulness, and then you go down to Congress? What was that from one world to the other?
Yeah, and the big difference is the hard part that I had is in the food world, I'm an expert. But, you get some people on the Hill go, all right, you're a chef. Like, really, I need to hear you talk about policy. But I did my homework. And the difference is I kept showing up.
Right.
So I testified at George Miller, who was a congressman from California. He retired a couple of years back. His committee, it was around the debate around school lunch, the childhood nutrition reauthorization, which then turned to the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act under the Obamas. And I say Obamas because both of them worked really, really hard on that issue of school lunch. And so I testified, and it was really great. And I was scared to death. And but I kept going back and I kept going back and, 6, 7, 8 times, 10 times a year, I was up on the Hill. And right before, Representative Miller retired, I was doing a press conference with him. And I think it was around transparency in the food system or something. And he took me aside and said, Tom, you keep showing up and we notice that. He said, a lot of celebrities, they come here. They're here once, it's a photo op, we never hear from them again. You keep showing up, and we know that, and that's why we're listening. And so that's the real lesson I learned. If they're not gonna go and listen to you, they're happy to come and take the photo with you.
Right.
They're happy to do that, right. But if you really wanna get your issue out there and have people focusing on it, you have to be a fly in the ointment. You've got to be there. You've got to show up all the time. And then all of a sudden they take it seriously.
Yeah, one of my mentors said to me once that advocacy is not a big bang, it's a drumbeat. And they got to hear that drumbeat. And when they hear Tom Colicchio and they hear your audience and they hear a million Twitter followers and they know that you know your shit, because you do know your shit, you are an expert on what you're there to talk about. And the smart ones will respect that and listen to that. I mean, Jon Stewart's another example, right? They know he keeps coming back. We did a show a couple of weeks ago about 9/11 first responders.
Yep, yep.
He keeps showing up. They know he's not going to go away and they can't just blow him off with an Instagram
And that's
photo.
It. And he's smart and he's intelligent about it. And, you know, I even love the fact that when he shows up, he doesn't show up in a suit and tie.
Yep.
And he's just like, this is who I am, and we're going to play on my terms now. And he's done a great job. And I got to tell you, I am so happy that he's doing it. And I was down there, talk about, again, chefs being first responders.
Yeah, I want to actually ask you about that.
About chefs being, and I never talk about this. And yeah. I'm happy to talk about it.
I would really appreciate it if you would, just to set the stage. So after 9/11, you were one of the folks who led an effort down there to help people.
Right.
So take us through that if you can.
I got married 4 days after 9/11. We got married. My wife and I got married on Martha's Vineyard. I was already on the vineyard when it happened. I was out fishing actually. And the captain I was with, I heard him talking to someone on the phone and I heard him. I was like, what did you just say? And I said, get me out of here right now. And he said, what's the matter? It's a great day. It's nice. I was like, I have a child close by and I have people I know who work in the trade center and it's my city and get me home. And, in fact, we were gonna postpone the wedding, and when we were first started to date, my wife and I ended up getting some kind of, it was almost like a dog tag, and it had this little thing on it that said, "Don't postpone joy," and that almost became like our rallying cry. And when I have two wedding rings on. Inside one of them, it says, "Don't postpone joy," and we talked to the rabbi who was marrying us, and we said, listen, we may have to call us off. And she said, don't. And she said, what's inside your ring? And she said, this is not a time to let the people who did this win, and this is a way of letting them win. But we didn't go on a honeymoon. We stayed on the vineyard for a couple more days, and immediately when I came down here, I was part of a bunch of chefs who got on the cruise lines where there was a kitchen, and we were feeding the first responders. And I worked the midnight shift. I got down there at 12 o'clock. And my first thing that I'd do every night would clean out the kitchen because it was always a mess.
Yeah.
And so clean out. And then we were there till 8 o'clock in the morning feeding people. And a couple of things were interesting. You saw people really break down. You saw these first responders, these brave people, at that moment when they were sitting there eating, just kind of lose it. And you kind of knew what they were going through. And there was a few things that they would tell us, like don't serve rice because for obvious reasons, there's, mm-hmm. you know, maggots crawling on body parts. I mean, mm-hmm. this is what I learned. And this is the stories you would hear. And this stuff stays with you. But, you know, the work that John's doing, so many people did whatever they could. I mean, I remember some guy running into the second or third night I was there. He comes into the kitchen. He goes, I desperately need ice. And I said, listen, I don't have ice here. I have a small amount, but I have restaurants. If you get me out of here and get me back in, because we would get actually board the boat over here, right off the pier here, and then take the boat down. And once we were on that boat, we weren't allowed to go off. And I said, if you can get me out of here and back in, I'll get you all the ice you want. And he's like, yeah, we did that. And we had a hard time getting back in, but we got back in.
Yeah.
But the amount, the effort that it took and watching it would happen and everyone sort of rallying around the flag and everyone sort of, you know, going on and on about how the great work these first responders did and they did. And then to have members of Congress decide that they are not going to actually pay, like follow through with the promises that they made to take care of these people. It's just unconscionable. And so, yeah, I love that John's doing this and you know, he's a damn good guy for a lot of other things that he does. He's a big animal rights activist, and I think he has his own sanctuary, animal rights sanctuary that he actually runs it. And he's but to do this and to keep showing up, and he will not stop.
Right.
And that's what's going to make a difference.
I think it's important for you to share the perspective of what it was like down there in those times, because I think folks see, you know, select images or they think back to the video footage of the actual attack. But I wrote about it extensively in my book, and it was the darkest, most tragic, most horrifying time, but it was also a time of joy and of hope and of inspiration and of unity, and that mm-hmm. feeling in the air that everybody was in this together was like nothing I ever felt before and have felt since, right? I mean, it was really a profound moment of unity. And food, in many ways, when I was in the Army, it was the same thing. It was that time to reflect, or that time to relax, or that time to just enjoy something that is so essential and simple.
Right.
And, you know, in the military, food is everything, man. My grandfather used to tell me food and mail is everything. So, right. I mean, well, do you think about that as a connective tissue in America? And especially one of the reasons I was excited to talk to you, Tom, is because it's Memorial Day. You know, Memorial Day week is coming up. The summer's starting. Food is such an essential part of America, but it's also a part of our politics. In the same way, I think liquor can be, and conversation, real political conversations don't happen with suits and ties. They right. happen around a dinner right. table, right. right? So tell us what you think about that.
So that's exactly right. And so when people ask me about why, you know, and I reflect back how I got involved in cooking, why it's important to me. You know, they always expect about, I'm passionate about my food and I go out and do this. Yeah, all that's fine. But it's not so much about the food, the plate of food, it's what it does. It brings people around a table. You know, when I was a kid growing up, I had to be home every night. But then you think about, if someone says, you know, what is that moment, that one inspiration that sort of got you cooking? And I had this conversation just yesterday with a journalist. When I was a kid growing up in New Jersey, my grandfather and I would crab and fish in Barnegat Bay. And I started probably at the age of 5. And I had two jobs besides fishing. It was to keep my grandfather awake on the ride home.
Right.
He would
right.
nod out.
Okay.
And I had to clean fish. So at a very young age, I had a knife in my hand learning how to clean fish, because he just would take a nap when he got home. But the memories of summer to me is my family sitting around a table picking crab, eating what we called crab gravy, because we would take the crabs and cook them, but then put them in marinara sauce and put that marinara sauce over linguine. So we had that, and then sitting around the table picking crab. And to me, that's summer.
Yeah.
But then when you think about it, all celebrations, whether it's a wedding, an anniversary, a death, there's usually food involved. But what food does, there's a certain comfort around it. But there's also a necessity. You look at the work that my great friend Jose Andreas is doing.
Yeah.
Where he just took it upon himself. The first one was Haiti. And I think it was also, and I think you can tie it right back to the work that happened around 9/11 as well. But when there was an earthquake in Haiti, he just decided he was going to go there and do something, because he realized something really important. Yes, you need people on the ground to deal with infrastructure and rebuilding. You need architects and engineers, and you need other NGOs to deal with water and to get the government up and running again, and to deal with you need doctors to deal with medical issues. But you need cooks to cook food.
Right, right, so, right, right.
And that wasn't happening.
Right.
And so food, you realize the power that it has, but it's, the power of bringing people together. I actually think that right now, if members of Congress are forced to eat with each other every day, they probably actually work out some of these problems.
I like that. That's a good policy suggestion.
Sit down and have a meal.
Mandatory meal.
Yeah.
Kind of like mandatory family meal or mandatory military meal. The team has to have a meal together. And I think that's missing now. They don't do that.
There was a Congressman Sutherland out of Florida when he got to Congress, he actually cared about hunger. And I heard the story. He was talking to his daughter, and he said, "No, I'm really frustrated because I want to sort of deal with hunger in America, and I don't know who to talk to." And she said, "Well, who's the guy who's really, you know, sort of doing this work?" Jim McGovern. "Well, why don't you sit down and talk to him?" "I can't. He's a Democrat. I can't talk to
really?
Him."
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
This is how it's got to. Like, we have this major issue that we can deal with and actually end hunger in this country with good programs that work, that we know that work, and the two sides can't get together and deal with it. I mean, and part of the only reason we got a decent farm bill this time around was because Pat Roberts, a Republican, just said, "We're not touching SNAP. We're not touching programs that feed people."
Right.
So the only way we're delivering a farm
SNAP,
bill,
food stamps, right?
Yeah. SNAP, right. Yeah. And so you had Republicans said, "No, we're not doing that. Yeah. I'm going to deliver a farm bill for my farmers, but we're not taking money away from this program that everybody needs."
So I want to stay on that issue, because I know you know.
I'm rambling.
You know,
I'm
no, no, you
kind
know,
of all over the place.
This
right
is
now.
Good. You know farming. You know the farm bill. And a couple of weeks ago, there was a discussion about how the tariffs on China, Trump's tariffs on China, are going to impact farmers.
Yep.
And Tom Cotton, the senator, from Arkansas stepped forward and basically said farmers should sacrifice for their patriotism. He appealed to the sense of patriotism and said, you know, be like the troops and give something up in service of your nation. In the meantime, farmers are having a hard time already just getting by. I mean, what's your reaction when you hear that kind of almost jingoism,
right?
Where farmers are sometimes being used as political props in the same way vets or so many other groups, right?
Yeah. And listen, my feeling on this was not, you can rally around the troops because they're there putting their ass on the line. And if you don't, whether or not you agree with that war or not, whether or not you agree that we should have been in Iraq, I don't think there's too much sort of disparity as to whether or not we should have been in Afghanistan. But even though once they're there, you support the troops. To me, it's pretty easy. But this isn't a war. This is someone's ego who doesn't quite understand how tariffs work. And I based it on the fact that he still believes that somehow this money is coming into the coffers of the government.
Right.
And he keeps on saying that. Farmers are getting screwed here. And they're getting screwed because they supported someone. I mean, rural America put him in office, and rural America is getting screwed because of his policies right now. And I still wouldn't say screw the farmers. I think that they should get a package to help bail them out because they're getting caught in the middle right now.
Right.
And so there's a new $15 billion proposal working its way through right now to help bail them out. But again, what this really is showing is how vulnerable the farming community is.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I mean, the prices for corn and soy are, I think, at an all-time low. And so they're at the point where, why should we even plant? It's just not worth it. And then they get a hit on tariffs on top of that. And here's the problem. If this war ends, this tariff war, why people call it a war, it's ridiculous. It kind of makes light of what war is.
Well, and it also effectively rallies people if you want to appeal to their populism or their nationalism right?
Right.
Yeah.
But just
it's politics at its worst in some ways. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But if we actually make a deal with China, these markets aren't going to open up again because they've already switched to markets. They're buying from Brazil. If they're buying soy from Brazil, they're not all of a sudden going to say, well, yeah, I guess we'll buy from the United States now. It's already done. So this isn't going to end that quickly. Tomorrow, if these tariffs end tomorrow, the markets aren't going to be flooded open. And so the farmers are still going to get screwed. And so I just would rather, again, someone should just talk sense into this guy and say, this is not the fight that you want right now. There's a way to peddle influence, and this is not it. And putting farmers' livelihoods at risk. And we know what this is going to do. It's going to create further consolidation in the farming industry, where there's going to be fewer family-owned farms, and the big, giant conglomerates are going to just buy these farmers up when they go out of business, and it's going to make it worse. And that's all this is doing, because the big farmers will get through this.
Yeah,
it's the guy who's planting 2,000 acres of corn and soy and feeding a few pigs on his property. They're going to get screwed in this, and this is just because you have someone who has a giant ego and who doesn't quite understand how this all works, and yet. Again, they're asking someone who didn't pick this fight and who didn't sign up for it. That's the other difference here. You go to war as a soldier, you're signing up to do that. You know the consequences of that, and you're doing it for the reasons that you have to do it. These farmers didn't sign up for this.
Right.
And so they're being told to be patriotic.
Right.
Well, damn, I think they're patriotic enough.
I want to come back to your thoughts on Trump, because you have not pulled any punches. And if anybody doesn't follow you on Twitter, they should after this show, because you drop bombs and you speak your mind, which I think is really, really an important part of your following. I think people have always trusted you as a guy who speaks the truth. But let's stay in the way back machine in New Jersey. We were talking on the walk in here about cars. We're at the Manhattan Car Club again. There's some pretty incredible cars here. But tell me, Tom Colicchio, what was your first car?
My first car, oh God, it's really cool. It's a 1972 Fiat Spider convertible. And the only reason it was mine, I don't know. So my dad got this car. A friend of his had like an auto body shop, you know, sell used cars as well. And my dad got this car. He actually got it for my brother, but there was no bill of sale. And I think I know how it happened now, but there was no bill of sale. And so when my brother was a year older, and so he ended up with this Toyota Corolla, And when the paperwork finally came around this car, I was of age, so I got that car.
Wow.
And it was pretty, it wasn't expensive at all at the time, but it was really cool to drive
what
around.
What color was
yellow.
This? What,
it was, yellow. It was yellow.
Wow.
It was, I think they referred to it as Fighting Lady Yellow.
Yellow.
I think that's it. It was pretty cool.
This question never disappoints. Every time I ask somebody this question, we get a surprising and an interesting answer. Do you know what happened to the car? Did you get rid of your brother got a Toyota?
I beat the hell out of that thing. I drove that thing into the ground until I can't tell you how many times I wasn't, prior to that, I tinker with stuff, but I had to sort of learn how to, replace an alternator and do a lot of work on the fly with that car. And it was a pretty simple, the electrical system never worked. Windshield wipers never worked. I learned to drive a car without windshield wipers.
And there was no bill of sale. So maybe this got traded for a bucket of crabs.
No, it ended up getting junked. It would not work anymore. It was falling apart. I drove the hell out of this thing. I had to have close to 100,000 miles on it when I got it. Wow. I easily put 100 plus on it in a very short time, but I took it everywhere. It was a great first car.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. And you've been taking your advocacy everywhere. You've seen this entire country. You've been out on the road across the world. You're now in many ways, not just an American ambassador, but a global ambassador for the issues you're talking about. You're known around the world. But I ask every guest, and I want to ask you this because I say all the time, if you're not angry, you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
What's one thing that's got you angry, Tom?
It's the day-to-day hypocrisy. It doesn't end. And so my big concern is that we don't return to the norms. I mean, even the norm, again, going back to 72, I think it was, presidents sort of opened up their taxes so people could see how they were making their money and whether or not they were entangled in foreign investments, things like that. But there was no law. This is a thing you did because you were decent. And the norms of governing this country are gone. And the question is, do they come back? The institutions are barely holding on right now. And the question is, do they come back? When you hear the President of the United States go after the FBI, go after our intelligence agencies, I mean, think about this. He's actually sat there and said, I actually believe Russia over our intelligence agencies. This is crazy. And so to me, it's the hypocrisy and around that, and whether or not we return back to normalcy after this presidency, or do we have to start creating laws? Now, I know there's laws on the books now, I believe in Maryland, Washington State, I'm sure a handful of other states right now, where you have to open up your tax information, or you're not getting on the ballot.
Right.
And so now we have to create laws.
Yeah.
And so to me, that's where I'm frustrated. I'm really frustrated at our lack of standing in the world now. And again, how do we get that back? That we've taken allies that we were aligned with for 200 years and just decided that it's not important. And this isn't normal.
Yeah.
There are things that just come out of his mouth that even if in the deep, darkest corners of a politician or a president of the United States, they think these things, they wouldn't say them because what can happen. They understood the power of the office. I don't think he understands the power that his words have.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So he just casually tosses them around.
Yeah, talked a lot about the command climate, the tone he sets, the example he creates, right? Or the anti-example. And right. I've seen it kind of cascade across America.
Right.
In the way people talk to each other. I mean, sure. Social media, obviously, yeah. I can't imagine what kind of crazy shit people throw at you on Twitter.
I don't get much pushback.
Really?
No, I don't, not as much really? As other people I know who are out there who...
Yeah. I mean, if I ever mention Chris Cuomo or Meghan McCain in my Twitter feed on any level, it's off the charts and like really nasty, frightening sometimes stuff.
I'll try that.
Those two in particular, right? And I've Cuomo or McCain just sets people off. Maddow maybe after last week is another story. But I want to ask you, Tom, so this climate, right, that he's creating as a leader, you're a leader, you've led in kitchens and in businesses and on shows, you set the tone as a leader. Do you see that cascading down into your restaurants? I love your restaurants. I was in Temple Court recently and I love it. But do you see the way your staff is treated, the way people treat each other in a restaurant when their guard is down, maybe they've had a couple drinks, does it bleed over into the way people are treating themselves, or does it go back the other way where now people are nicer, or is there no change at all?
No, I think because we're in New York City, I think people are being nicer. They're more cognizant of sort of what they're saying and how they say it. And I think there's this series that I'm doing where we're opening up our restaurant so new voices can come out. That to me is a direct result of this presidency. Because you are getting, especially minorities, people of color in this country that are just, they're taking back their story. They are not letting someone define who they are and what it means for them to be American. And so, and I think that is a direct result of what's going on in our political climate. Mm. So I actually think I don't know if it's a silver lining, but I think especially in New York, I see it in LA too, where people are reaching out. They are sort of understanding what privilege means. And so for me, part of the reason I'm doing this series is yes, I do occupy a position of privilege, not only because I'm white, but in my industry especially. I have privilege. I've been there 30 plus years and I'm a leader in the industry. And so for me, it's not enough to sit on the sidelines and applaud and say, isn't this great that this is happening? What do I do to make it happen? What do I do not to open that door, but to welcome someone in, set that table for them, and give them a seat at that table.
Right.
That's my responsibility, not to sit there and go, isn't this great? This is happening, and I'm open to it. That's not enough anymore. And yeah. So I think that you're seeing more bridges being built, and you're seeing more people reach out because of what's going on.
And at a time when American leadership on the political side is lacking, our entertainment and our cultural influences seem to continue to rise. So, yes. And I think about, you know, the role of Bourdain in shaping what it means to be American. Top Chef, Chef's Table now is a huge hit, right? So these are global hits, but they're coming out of America, right? Many of them. And they're raising these kind of rock star Americans. So what is the future for many of them are activists, right? I talk a lot about activism. So you're melding not just business and creativity, but activism, your principles, what you stand for. Mm-hmm. Do you see a generation of political leaders? Do you see anybody who might run for office? And I'm going to ask you this too. Would you ever run for office yourself?
There are times I think about it. I have been asked, but I no. There's a lot of reasons why I don't think I'd be right for it. I don't work well in groups.
That didn't stop another guy from running for governor in New Jersey.
This is right? True.
That guy didn't work too well in groups. He was governor for a long time.
No, he didn't.
And ran for president.
No, he didn't. What I'm seeing, and this is what we did. So for years, I kept my advocacy separate than my business.
Right.
And again, this is, I believe also a correlation, a direct correlation because of the political climate we're in right now. I'm starting to see more and more people bring their advocacy work in line with their business. And I think people want to know where you stand on issues nowadays. And I think it has to be one and the same. And so that's what I'm seeing in my industry right now is that you have chefs. So the James Beard Foundation, they do our awards it started out as a way to keep, James Beard had a townhouse on 12th Street here in Manhattan. And after he died, it was a way to keep that house from being sold off. And it was turned into like kind of a museum. But what they're doing now, going about 6 years ago, they realized that they had to actually use their voice to support change in not only in our industry but in farming and things like that. So you're seeing this, and what they do is they actually start a boot camp and they teach chefs how to be advocates, how to go up on the hill and lobby. And so when I was with Food Policy Action, we would do a lobby day, and we did it, you know, 4 or 5 times a year. We'd bring 60, 80 chefs to the hill. And these chefs were all really well versed because they were trained on how to lobby. And boy, when you go there and you have a business, you're in Asheville, North Carolina, and you have a business and you employ people.
Absolutely.
That member listens.
Absolutely.
And so you're seeing more and more that chefs are not willing to sit on the sidelines anymore. They're willing to fight for what they believe in. And they fight for their communities and what their communities need. And so it's changing now. Mm-hmm. And again, I think this is part and parcel of where we are.
Yeah.
You didn't see this, you know, under any other, you know, president where people are so willing to engage. And, you know, it used to be, well, I don't want to piss off, you know, a bunch of people. They won't come to my restaurant. Now it's like,
no. They want to know where you get your food, how you do your hiring, what kind of business you practice, right?
And that's all political
Yeah.
in a way.
But it should be, right? Because like in many places, you know, the local restaurant or even the kitchen table is where you learn how to treat people. Right. You learn about leadership. You learn about teamwork.
They call it kitchen table issues for a reason.
Many folks, you know, from the military community have talked about mandatory public service of some kind, right? Marine Corps or AmeriCorps. But I've also believed that on some levels, maybe working in the service industry should be mandatory. One of my first jobs was in the service industry. I've been a busboy. I've been a waiter. I've been a bouncer. Yeah. I've been a bartender. My grandparents actually met in a restaurant. They worked at a Greasy Spoon. My grandmother was a waitress and my grandfather was an immigrant from Germany who barely spoke English and worked in the back of the kitchen. They met in a restaurant. Decades ago. Yeah. And that's a lot of stories in this country. Well,
God forbid you're a bartender and you become a member of Congress. Then all of a sudden, like, you're not qualified, right?
Or you're John Boehner, right?
There's that, right? Yeah.
But do you think about that? Like, when, you know, you have kids, you have sons, you know, do you think about how much they learn or people learn working in a restaurant, even getting along with other people, how to deal with customers, how to manage money? There's so many important parts of life that you learn in the restaurant.
I would agree with you, but to say that should be mandatory is really self-serving for me. there is a lot to learn when you're in the restaurant business, and it's really just how to deal with people.
Right.
And that's what it all comes down to. It's like, how do you just sort of, someone's coming in here, they had a hard day at work, you know, or they got in a fight with their spouse or whatever. And you've got to figure all that out right away, very quickly sum that up. And so you get if you're in the service industry, you get a pretty good sense on sort of human nature right away and sort of how to deal with it and how to navigate it. And but I agree. I think there should be some sort of, mandatory service. And so I think again, for me, it's like, how do you sort of catch? So the idea of free education, right? And a lot of people are talking about free college right now. And I think that's a bad way to go. Now, before he jumps down my throat, let me explain.
No, go for it. It's only me and you. I'm not jumping down your throat. We have no commercial breaks. Right. This is the advantage of a podcast.
The people out there listening. When a lot of people out there hear free education, especially someone who's just paid for the kids to go to college, maybe they just graduated, they're like, why do I want to take my tax dollars? I want my tax dollars to go somewhere else. Why should I go to pay, you know, for free education? Well, let's sort of reframe that a little bit. How about we call that 14 years of public education, right? So for the last 5-6 years, the buzz was pre-K. And in New York now, we have pre-K available to everybody here because we realized that kids who weren't in pre-K, they were getting left behind.
Right.
And wealthier people who could afford to send their kids to a pre-K program that was paid for, when they got to school, they had a leg up. So that happened here in New York City. We have universal pre-K. So now we need to talk about, it used to be if you had a high school education, you could pretty much get by. You can get a job in a factory making a decent wage. You were living a middle-class life. You had a house, maybe it wasn't a big house, it wasn't in some fancy neighborhood, but you had a house, you got a car every 5-6 years, you took a vacation here and there, and you can get by, it was fine. You can't do that anymore. That doesn't work anymore. Mm. So what do we need? At least 2 years of additional public education. There was a time in this country we did not have public education. Right. And when we started it, everyone who wanted it was labeled a socialist. You're labeled a socialist, and at the time, only wealthy people sent their kids to school. And maybe there were some charity, cases for kids who were really smart to get that leg up. So instead of calling it free college, let's call it 14 years of public education. Now, all of a sudden, that sounds very different. Now, you tie that into a mandatory service component, I think that's great.
I think this is the basis of a gubernatorial campaign in the state of New Jersey.
I live in New York now.
Look, and to that point, we've got a guy in the mayor of New York City, Mayor de Blasio, who is now running for president. I'm not a fan. I think he's been a disaster and has wrecked many parts of this city. But what he's going to run on is now free pre-K, right? Yeah. Like, my kid is now a pre-K age. It's an option for us. And on a very basic level, I'm a fan of this, okay? Like, I will give him credit for that. I think it's a huge policy win. And on a basic level, is this not really significant simply because some kids will get fed, right? If they go to pre-K, they'll get school lunch or they'll get some kind of food and at least be a competitive advantage if
they were
home.
Absolutely, but you know what's going on right now? In de Blasio's budget, and this is someone who thinks he's a progressive, he is looking to cut $24 million out of the school breakfast program. Because right now, there's a big movement towards breakfast after the bell.
Yeah.
So you get breakfast in first period. Number one, it gets rid of the stigma of being the kid that has to go and get breakfast. Also, studies have been done where math scores go up by 30%. when kids eat breakfast. Rates of absenteeism drops. Rates of you know, getting in trouble, going to the principal's office drops. So this is a great program. And now they're actually looking to cut $24 million out of that budget for breakfast after the bell. It's just unconscionable. This works. And so the idea that this very progressive, you know, mayor is going to do this is and I don't follow New York City politics as much as I should. I follow more sort of national politics. I don't whether he was a disaster. I mean, he got universal again, the breakfast passed, mm-hmm. and now he's looking to cut it. I don't get it.
Did he give a rationale for why?
I don't think so.
See, this could also be right now, but this is also De Blasio to me. He does dumb shit that he doesn't explain.
But I don't know if he's doing it. I don't even know if he knows. Yeah, I think
that's another example of why he's been a disaster. He actually opposed a couple years ago. Part of why, you know, I've been a pretty consistent critic of his is a couple years ago here in New York City. We did not have a Department of Veteran Services, a Department of Veteran Support. We had one of the biggest populations in the country of veterans of all generations. Right. And he actually opposed the creation of a department, the ultimate socialist mayor, the guy who's all about government programs, for some reason, inexplicable reason, opposed this. And this is the kind of stuff that's caused a lot of friction with him around not just vets, but cops, firefighters.
Right.
He's hit these inexplicable third rails. Right. And I think his tone deafness and maybe a lack of, frankly, competence is what's going to come back to get him. But also, to your point, we talk a lot about New York in this show, in part because now New York politics is national politics. Our president talks a lot about how he came from here. Now we've got a mayor, we've got a senator running, and Gillibrand running for president. You've been a ferocious critic of Trump. Has he ever come in one of your restaurants when you were there?
Not that I know of. He's not the guy wants to eat out a lot. And I think also he doesn't like to pay for his meal. So he has to go to his places so he doesn't have to pay. I met him once on a golf course. At his golf course in New Jersey. I knew the pro working there. I knew him from a club down in South Carolina. And it was a quick hi and goodbye. That was it.
Right. And so what do you think about him, you know, serving, you know, Chick-fil-A and Burger King when people come to the White House? I mean, again, not to dismiss it, but seriously, right? The president says, hey, welcome to the White House. Here's Burger King.
It's a terrible thing to do. Again, right now, we have such a problem in this country with nutrition. Do you know right now we're spending $200 billion a year on healthcare costs that are associated with poor diet in the form of diabetes and other issues around obesity, heart disease? And so what kind of example are you leading when you're telling people, like, you know, junk food's okay? Occasionally, yeah, it's fine, but the message should be, the message that Michelle Obama put out there, health and nutrition is really important, and being able to afford nutrition is important. We have the problem that we have in this country is calories are cheap, nutrition is expensive. You want to go feed your family nutritious food, it costs a lot of money.
Right.
And so what we have, right, you know, that to me is an example of a broken food system, and it's broken because it's not reaching everyone. And that's the problem. So, and it's very similar to, I guess, the veterans issue around the hospitals. It's available, service is available, but it's not available to everyone.
Right.
And the service is it's great for some things, but not great for other things. And wait lines, you know, the lines are too long. People are waiting. And so it's not that we should just scrap this. It's make it better. And so we have a food system in this country that can produce a lot of food. There's a lot of abundance, but we're producing cheap calories, and it's actually not reaching everyone because it's not reaching people because they don't have the dollars to pay for it.
Right.
And so there's a problem here. So we have to fix that problem. Right. But that's just a good example of how the system's broken.
I think, you know, food's one of those basic things that people forget how important it is in politics and in policy. There was a story recently about how the Department of Defense was contemplating cutting the was a relatively small budget for lobsters in the military. I don't know if you saw this, Tom, but there was basically something like $20 million allocated to lobsters in the military. And the military budget's hundreds of billions of dollars. And people said, you know what? What do they need lobsters for? And the vets community actually pushed back and said, you know what? There was this flood of stories that, you know, the day my guys got blown up, we got lobster. Or once a year, we look forward to lobster. And even from a logistical standpoint, like, it's a good training exercise for the military to figure out if they can deliver a lobster to a remote outpost in Afghanistan. But for us in the military, especially, food was that one thing you could look forward to.
Right.
I mean, I'll always remember, you know, the Thanksgiving dinner. Everywhere you go, you see that one plate of Thanksgiving dinner, and it's a piece of home.
Right.
And I think people tend to forget how essential it is to being American.
Right. So what's interesting is that needs explanation. Yeah. Because when you said that, I was like, the first thing in my mind was like, Yeah, like, who's getting these lobsters? Because I immediately thought, like, officers getting lobster, else is getting, like, you know.
Like, hey, once a year, you know, hey, Navy SEALs, or hey, transportation unit that's been busting your ass for a year.
That all makes
sense.
You know,
America doesn't think you should eat shit every day. Here, you know what? We put a man on the moon. We're going to take people to Mars. We can get you a lobster tail once a year if that's your jam.
But again, I'll go back to it. That is America, because, again, we opened this conversation talking about how you celebrate anniversaries and weddings and important milestones with food. And so if you could say, hey, you guys did a great job and you're getting a better meal today.
Yeah.
That's how I grew up. It's like, you know, something happened. It's like, hey, we're going to, you know, either my mother was cooking a special meal, or maybe that, you know, we're going to go out to dinner. So that was a treat.
Right.
And so, yeah, so I get it. Why that's a treat, and why.
My mother would do something that was very radical at the time, Carvel dinner. When she didn't want to cook and she didn't want to go out, she said, you know what? My mother was very popular in the neighborhood. But if my mom said, hey, we're doing Carvel dinner, we'd all pile in the car, go to Carvel ice cream, which was regional soft serve.
Right.
And that was a hit, man. That was my favorite dinner.
Right.
I know it's not fancy, but shit. No, nothing beat Carvel dinner in the summertime.
Right. Yeah. We used to do that with Friendly's. Because I think Friendly's is kind of the same thing, but Friendly's, and they had food. But yeah,
all due respect, Friendly's is not the same as Carvel.
I don't know. We didn't have Cookie Puss in the Whale of a Cake. I mean, so that's
okay.
You know,
all right. I knew we'd finally get something we could get into.
And how genius is that? One shape becomes what, five or six different things? It's brilliant.
Cookie Puss was genius.
Cookie Puss
was amazing.
He was Whale of Dad.
Yeah.
He was everything. Yeah.
Fudgy the Whale. Yeah.
And
Cookie Puss.
Father's Day was Whale of Dad. Yeah.
See, yeah. It was just, but Christmas, I got to tell you,
it was Santa too, turned upside down too.
I got to tell you though, I love Carvel, but I like Baskin Robbins ice cream cakes better than Carvel, in part because it has actual cake in it.
Yeah.
Your thoughts, Tom?
Well, my favorite, when I was a kid growing up, there was a Dairy Queen down the street. And Dairy Queen, we would go there as kids.
So you're picking the third-party option.
But then when we were older, and when we were teenagers, that was our hangout.
I'm glad that you were sitting on the subject, because folks who have listened to previous podcasts, or if you've heard me on the radio, sometimes a guest host for Chris Cuomo on Sirius XM channel 124, I have a debate of the day. And I present an issue and I say, you must choose one side. This is one case where I don't want to bring people together. I want to force them to choose. You have to choose red or blue. You have to choose one side or the other. And the most popular question I've ever had that I am dying to hear your response to, Tom Colicchio, is pancakes or waffles? If you could only choose one, there is no third party option. There is no French toast. There's no Howard Schultz or Ross Perot. You must pick one. Pancakes or waffles?
No Jill Steins. No Jill Steins in this one?
No Jill Steins.
Awesome. I like that. Easy pancakes.
Why?
One of the first things I made as a kid.
Really?
Yep. I looked at my mom making pancakes and said, I could do that. And so I remember waking up. And my son just did this recently. He woke up and on his own made pancakes. My 9-year-old.
That's a big deal.
I looked at it and said, I crack an egg. I mean, it was like Angemon box mix, but still, you crack an egg, you put some milk in there. I could do that.
My kid's three. Like, the idea of him making his own pancakes is like heaven to me.
Yeah.
I would love to see my kid crack open a box of anything and make anything right now. Yeah, right now, he just climbs the refrigerator. I hope he doesn't fall backwards.
Yeah.
He's like a spider monkey going up in there trying to get yogurt.
Yeah. Pancakes.
Okay.
Pancakes.
So I want every episode I ask folks to think about, you got into it, Tom. You're great about understanding that there are some folks out there listening, maybe you're having a bad day, maybe having a bad week, a bad year, a hard time. You've been, you know, kind of a rags to riches story. You've been an American success story. Mm-hmm. And part of why I was excited to have you on here is because you're an inspiration to other people. Do you have any lessons learned as a leader, as someone who's, you know, many times probably grinded out with no TV cameras when nobody was watching, you know, do you have a message for that guy or gal that's out there, you know, grinding it out on kind of how you got where you are?
God, you know, that's a tough one. If I had a look at my career, I think I was lucky that I found something that I loved to do, that at the time I started doing it, I got in with the right people. I mean, I did my homework. I mean, I didn't go to culinary school. I started cooking because I loved food. There was a moment where the secret of food was unlocked. It was a funny story. My dad, I was cooking at home, and I would have been diagnosed with ADHD. All my kids have been diagnosed, and it's an official diagnosis, not diagnosis, not like a, you know, we think he's hyperactive.
Right.
And so I would look at a recipe and I couldn't get through it. I struggled to get through it. I couldn't understand what they were trying to do. I'd read it, you know, I keep reading it, I'd refer to it. It just was a struggle. And my dad, he was a correctional officer in a county jail, and I'm not quite sure what this book was doing in the library in the county jail, but he came home with a book by a chef named Jacques Pepin, and it was called La Technique. And in this book, there were some recipes, but Jacques stressed in this book that it was about techniques and methods, not so much about recipes. Mm. And once I saw that, I was like, I don't need recipes. I could just cook. If I understand how to roast a meat or braise a piece of meat or cook a fish or fillet a fish, then I can kind of do anything. And the rest of it is just kind of putting things together and understanding relationships of one food to the other. And boy, that changed my life. And so for me, if I didn't find that, I don't know what I would do. I was a terrible student because I was really hyperactive. I probably had a lot of issues with executive function. And, you know, I became the problem kid. Mm. I was in Catholic school, which is probably where I shouldn't have been. And I just became the kid who was a problem. So I'm like, oh, you're going to label me a problem kid? I'm going to be a problem kid.
Right.
And I got lucky. I found food. And so my suggestion is, even if it takes you 10 different things that you need to try, find something that you're passionate about. And I remember once I started cooking, I was all in. I read everything I can get my hands on. So I knew who was who. I knew the restaurants I wanted to work in. And I spent 10 years in New Jersey looking at the skyline and knowing that there were great restaurants across the river, but I wouldn't go there until I thought I was ready to compete. Mm. And so I just think is you find that thing that you want to do and, man, just dive in. Don't hesitate. Just jump in and you'll make your way. I think I was lucky. My dad, you know, he wasn't the kind of dad who sat down and had these long discussions about like your life. But my brothers, I have two brothers, and they're both successful in their careers. My older brother was a CPA, and now he's a CFO of a company. My younger brother is one of the most successful basketball coaches in New Jersey history, mm-hmm. and that includes Bob Hurley. Mm-hmm. My dad just somehow, and my mom, just without telling us, just made it known that, hey, find what you want to do and you'll be all right.
That's an amazing story.
So that's it.
And it started with a book that your dad got from inside the jail?
Yep. At least that's the story that he told me. And I can't believe he was in a bookstore finding these books. But yeah, it was a book that was in the jail.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So since we're on the basketball topic, I can't let you get off that. I mean, NBA Finals is coming up. Have you been watching? And do you have a thought on basketball in general?
I haven't been. I don't
maybe
watch.
You could coach the Knicks. That might help. There's a couple teams, maybe the Lakers. There's a couple teams out there that could use you or your brother to get them in line.
I don't watch a lot of professional sports anymore. I stopped. I had a gambling habit when I was a kid, when I was young, in my 20s. And once I stopped, I went cold turkey. I actually went a whole football season and won, which is you have to win like 70% of your bets if you win.
Yeah.
And the person I was betting with, we just had the running tab. Yeah. And at the end of the season, he owed me money. And I was like, keep it. I'm done. And I never gambled again.
Wow.
And I go to Vegas because I have a restaurant there and I sit down and play some blackjack. But I never gambled. But I stopped watching sports after that.
Wow.
It wasn't as interesting anymore.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't watch. But I mean, you know, Steph is such a great, I think just a great role model.
Steph Curry.
Yeah. Steph Curry is such a great, I love when Golden State wins. I think because of him also, I love the poll. God, why am I forgetting the coach's name? Coach for Golden State. He's also not afraid to put his politics front and center. Steve Kerr.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't mind seeing them win again.
All right. So I've got one last question for you that I ask all the guests. And you've really taken us through, I think, a really fascinating journey through your life and this intersection of politics and food and policy and grit and determination. And I ask everybody what's something that makes them angry, but Tom Colicchio, what's something that makes you happy?
What makes me happy? My dog.
Your dog?
No, my family. I go home and seeing my kids there and my wife especially and
your wife's awesome by the way.
And
she's really
the
amazing.
Home that we've created and our friends. I mean, to me, that's how I kind of judge things nowadays. My real happy places are I have a house on North Fork, Long Island, and that's kind of my happy place. And we're heading out there this weekend. And we have a close group of friends out there as well. And you know, that's really it. At the end of the day, I think you know I'm happy when I'm with people I love Yeah, that's awesome.
That's a good one, man.
That's it.
That's a good one.
Easy.
And I have a final
My dog makes me happy.
So tell us about your dog.
Oh, she's a flat coated retriever. She's 10 years old.
Dude, you're talking faster now that you're excited about your dog. Yeah. I love this.
I'm trying. I notice how these podcasts go because you try to get all this in a certain amount of time. So it gets sped up.
Dude, we got all the time.
When you broadcast it, it's on faster speed. And so all of a sudden...
I'm trying not to do that, man. This is uncut. This is no commercials. Cool. You can curse. No, this is a real conversation.
My dog, she's a flat coat retriever. She's the sweetest thing in the world.
What's your dog's name?
Her name is Piper. And she's getting old. She's 10 years old. And you know, I'm starting to think about like that. I'm going to... between now and the next couple of years, like she's not gonna be around, and then starting to really bum me out. And she has an injury, and she's limping now. But
what do you feed? What does Tom Colicchio feed his dog?
Okay, so we're on a new thing right now. This is gonna sound really horrible. Because we were feeding her, we feed her kibble, and we had a low fat. She has pancreatitis, so she's on a low fat diet. But we recently, I'm sitting going, I have so much scrap stuff, meaning like ends of fish and stuff.
Right.
If I give her raw fish, like I fish. I'm a fisherman. Yeah. She'll eat raw fish all day long, and so I'm starting to like once a week, make something. We actually spent some time with my wife did. She's a researcher and researches everything, and spent some time on the right diet if you're going to make food for your dog, and the right ratio of vegetables to grains to meat or fish. And so just recently I started making food for her. I hate to say that.
No, that's love, man. I mean, if you didn't make food for your dog, I would frankly question your love for your dog. Because it's what you do, man.
We've been opening cans, and my wife finally said, she has this inflammation. She's limping around. And like, you know what? I think we can fix it through diet. And so I was like, all right. You know, we have her on CBD.
Your dog's been sitting here for 10 years going, hey, bud, what about me? Right?
She gets some decent scraps every now and then. And I always sneak her food. You know, if there's a roast, her
jam. She kind of hit the lottery.
Her jam
like,
is this.
House that you end up in, like to end up in Colicchio's house, is a pretty good place.
She did okay. Her jam is, I make a lot of chicken soup at home, especially in the winter. And I sit there, and when I make chicken soup, the whole chicken goes in a pressure cooker, 20 minutes, water, 20 minutes, open it up, vegetables go in, 5 more minutes, done. Great, delicious.
That's it.
So then I take the meat off the bones. But the meat that's kind of really stuck to the bones, after we put the meat in the soup, I go and scrape all the bones down. She gets that. And it's also all the skin, all the cartilage and stuff. That's her thing.
If dogs go to heaven, they end up at your place in the North Fork eating your chicken soup, man.
Yeah, but she's...
All right, well, you've been giving the dog a gift, an America gift. And I, as tradition is on this show, I have some gifts for you.
Oh,
so I'm going to hand you, this is a camouflage bag. It's Memorial Day weekend, so I'm sticking with the theme here. But there's a couple things in here, some of which I give every guest. Well, pretty much all of which I give every guest. So the first thing you've got is some new Angry American swag.
Oh, I love that.
For you and for your wife and for the boys.
Look at that.
It's Made in America by Oscar Mike, veteran-owned small business. You can get it online at angryamericans.us. You wear it when you're fishing. I think we had Matto on last episode, the two of you and a fishing thing. There's some magic here. We could get you two out fishing together.
I fly fish. I tie my own flies, and
you could have a lot of side hustles
for a short time.
Dog food,
yeah,
all kinds of stuff.
For 2 years, I was a correspondent for MSNBC until the Trump presidency, and they were like, "What do we need a guy doing food policy for? Get out of here!"
Yeah.
But I would love to go out fishing with Rachel. I'm a huge fan. I actually listened to that podcast. I have one question for you. Can I do a question?
Sure.
You serve the country. You're doing a ton of work now with the vets right now. When are you running?
I'm running for my life, man.
No.
Seriously. I mean it. I talked to, I think I talked to Sarah Jessica Parker about this. I think number one, I'm an independent. And that's part of what this show is about, is that I'm unaffiliated. I'm an independent. And unless you're, hold on, don't jump ahead to the gifts yet. The challenge really is like, there's not a, if you want to serve, which I always want to serve and I want to try to find a way to make an impact. But as an independent, especially in a place like New York, like unless you're Michael Bloomberg and a billionaire, there's really no way. And I think that's part of why the system is broken. Like many people have said, the political system is broken. If you are an independent, if tomorrow I ran in New York, okay, where the Democratic machine is so strong and so heavy, it wouldn't happen. But beyond that, for me, Tom, like the no shit is that I want to find the way I can make the most impact. And I think media is that place right now. I look at people like Rachel. I look at how powerful Hannity is, right? I mean, they're able to drive policy today. We had a really great conversation on an issue that I don't think a lot of folks heard about and maybe my audience didn't know enough about. So for me, honestly, that's where I want to be. And I've also, I raised money in a nonprofit for 15 years and that shit sucks. I do not want to be raising money.
That's one of the reasons I won't run.
That's the terrible part of it. Yeah. Like people don't know behind the curtain that my friends that I know that are in Congress, you don't read, you don't have a life. You're constantly dialing for dollars. So maybe if you and I start a fly fishing company or a dog food company and I become a billionaire and after you run for governor of New Jersey. Now, the next thing I have for you, going back to the gifts, right? And this is a risky one to go with Tom Colicchio, okay? So all season, I'll hold the mic for you. I'll hold the mic for you because this is audio.
This is really cool. It's a camo bag.
This is a camo inside the bag. Now, all season long, I've asked all my guests to choose, make a very tough choice again. Now, this is probably sacrilege for you.
This is great.
But we've got peeps.
These are peeps.
We've got blue,
these are peeps.
Yellow, and pink.
Yeah.
And I ask each guest to tell me which one they would choose and why.
Okay, here's the deal. Blue is my favorite color. Pink, for a lot of reasons, are really cool, especially because of breast cancer awareness. It's the color pink. Awesome. But peeps, yellow's the original. Man, you got to go with the original. Come on, you can't. I'm telling you, man.
Sarah Jessica Parker, in a previous episode, called them the OG of peeps.
Yeah, exactly. It's the OG of peeps. Chickens, like little chicks, are yellow. They're not blue and pink.
Do they? I mean, yeah, in your expert palate, is there a taste differential between the three?
Absolutely not. I haven't had one of these in about 20 years.
All right. Well,
my kids will love these. My wife will hate me for giving them to the kids.
Okay.
But the kids will get these.
And the last thing I have for you, Tom, is each week, I try to pick a...
I'm going to tell you what this is before I open it up.
Okay, go ahead.
Because it's either one of two things, but I actually think this is Rodham Rye.
You got to open it and find out. You got to open it and find out.
Well, so, let me just say, it's wrapped in silver, right? So I can't see what it is. I know it's liquid. It's kind of feeling like it's alcohol. And I happen to know...
I'm going to pick up your mic so that you can open it. This is audio, and you can hear... This is the sound of Tom Colicchio opening... A bottle. Now, regular listeners, you know it's...
Oh, no, Jefferson. Oh, cool. Awesome.
So each week I pick an American whiskey of some kind that I go to the liquor store and I try to be inspired by what I see. Now, this one was kind of easy because it's a Jefferson. And,
yeah, you know, this
you
is...
You can tell
this
folks
is,
what it says.
This is awesome. So
it's the chef's collaboration.
Yeah, now let me see who...
I didn't plan. I walked in a liquor store and there's a bourbon called a chef's collaboration.
Yeah, so this
so
is...
So I kind of had to get that one for you, right?
Yeah, so I can't see... I don't know the other signature, but this is definitely Edward Lee, who's a great Korean-American chef who's in Louisville. Now he's in D.C., actually. And so he is one of the collaborators on this. And I knew he was doing this project. And I hate to say, I don't know who the other chef is on this. I can't tell.
Well, it's from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah.
And I thought that you could enjoy it on your boat this weekend or when you're fishing or maybe slip it to your dog.
Yeah. I don't drink when I'm out fishing, but I will drink afterwards. I love bourbon. This is a fantastic one. And I just spent, you know, last season at Top Chef, we were in Kentucky. I spent about 6 weeks in Kentucky and awesome place. Louisville was really eye-opening because it was much more progressive than I thought
Louisville
it was going
to
be.
Awesome.
And, awesome bourbon. But you know, there's a lot of great bourbon out there right now. So,
well,
awesome. This is
great. I appreciate your passion. I didn't know, man. I'm rolling the dice here. Like to hand you anything that goes into your body, and you know that's a risky. You know, you could have fried me on this one, but I did okay on the peeps.
No, this is awesome.
On the bourbon.
I'm looking at the side here. Ed Lee is the chef, and then Trey Zoller. I couldn't tell the singer. Trey Zoller is the master distiller over there. What I love about this on the side, it says ridiculously small batch.
Yeah,
I have a restaurant that we just opened up called Small Batch, so this is pretty cool.
I didn't plan that. I didn't plan that, but I'll take the coincidence.
I will drink this and think of you this weekend.
Well, and we will think of you. You've given us a lot to think about in this show. I really want to thank you, man, for breaking it down with me, for joining us on Angry Americans, and for your voice.
Thanks.
You're out there doing a lot that's helping a lot of people, and especially around the summertime as we think about Memorial Day, we think about the summer coming up, and think about this important time in American history. You know, you're a person who's defined what it means to be American in some way, and I think you're going to define the future. So I'm really grateful and thankful that you joined me on the show.
Thanks, and I think just a good point here, Memorial Day, while you're out there, you know, eating, you're celebrating, which is great. There's There are 42 million Americans in this country that struggle to put food on the table every single day. And we can fix that. We can end that. It just takes political will, and it takes people to understand the issue and demand that we fix it. And the reason you should want to fix it is because it makes us a stronger country. I sat next to a general when I testified years ago in a committee that I talked about earlier, from Mission Readiness. Do you know the organization? Yeah. And he said, national security, he made an argument for why feeding people and having good nutrition is in best interest of national security. 25% of the recruits that show up aren't fit to fight.
Yeah.
And so when you think about 42 million Americans that are hungry, you think about children who can't live up to their potential. Those first 1,000 days especially are so important for brain development. They're not going to be able to contribute to their fullest to this country and what makes this country really great. And that is everybody participating and everybody staying involved. You need good nutrition to do that. And so this isn't about a handout. This is about what's good for the country, making sure that people have nutrition and they're properly fed.
That's a good note to end on, my brother. Thank you for joining me, man. Have a great summer. Really appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, the great Tom Colicchio, an outstanding American, joining us on Angry Americans this week, live from the Classic Car Club. Thanks for being with us. Every episode, I want to share with you a way to turn your anger, frustration, motivation, and/or inspiration into action. An action that shows this is more than just a show, it's a community. A community of concerned and connected citizens who don't just complain or attack, but a community that takes action. A righteous action that shows angry Americans can be impactful Americans. An action that'll make you feel good and make a difference. And this episode is about the power of food in politics. And this week, Memorial Day week, is also about remembering all those who can't barbecue this summer. All those who gave everything. So we could take a weekend to forget about everything. All those who came before and should never be forgotten. Memorial Day is the unofficial start of summer. Originally, it was known as Decoration Day. It originated in the years after the Civil War and became an official federal holiday only in 1971. Now, the Civil War ended in the spring of 1865 and claimed more lives than any conflict in U.S. history. And it required the establishment of the country's first national cemeteries. By late 1860s, Americans in towns and cities started holding springtime tributes to countless fallen soldiers, and they would decorate their graves with flowers, and they would recite prayers. Now, it's not exactly clear where the tradition originated, but in 1966, the federal government declared Waterloo, New York, the official birthplace of Memorial Day. Waterloo, which first celebrated the day back on May 5th, 1866, was chosen because it had an annual community-wide event, which closed businesses and residents decorated the graves of soldiers with flowers and flags. But that's where it really officially started in America. Since then, Memorial Day has become a time of family and friends and mattress sales. But it's also a time that underscores the deep, profound civil-military divide in America. It's a time when many veterans go to a cemetery and many Americans go to the beach. But to each his own. No matter what you choose to do, you can still take a minute to stop wherever you are and remember the fallen. All those we've lost in combat since the founding of our nation. And for me, that means soldiers I serve with, like Specialist Jason Bontz, Sergeant Major Eric Cook, Specialist Robert Wise, who was 21 years old when he was killed outside our forward operating base by a roadside bomb. And for me, it means people like my friend Ed Iwan, Lieutenant Ed Iwan. Ed and I served together. We went to infantry officer basic school together in Fort Benning, Georgia. He was a really nice guy from Nebraska. He had red hair and a friendly smile. Ed was the son of Kenneth and Donna Iwan. He died in Fallujah, Iraq, when his convoy came under attack. He was directing his dismounted troops when his Bradley got hit by an RPG.
Ed was 28 years old. He was kind. He was my friend. And I miss him. And I don't want him to be forgotten. He didn't serve a president or a war. He served his country. He was a true soldier. And he served knowing he might die, just like all of us who put the uniform on. But he did it in part so we could enjoy life and so we could live free. Now, each year on Memorial Day, a national remembrance takes place at 3 o'clock local time. And my recommended action this week is to do what Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America started a decade ago. Go silent. It's gotten pretty big over the years. We ask everyone, no matter where you are, to take 1 minute to go silent. Whoever you're with, just observe a 1 minute moment of silence. And after you do it, take a photo and use the hashtag Go Silent. Share who you're going silent for. If you don't know someone, share why you're grateful for those who gave their lives or a photo of where you are. It's simple, it's easy, and it's powerful. Every year, wherever I am, whoever I'm with, I ask our crew to hold hands, just bow our heads and breathe deeply and listen to wherever we are and just be together in gratitude. It's just 1 minute, but it's really powerful. There's an inscription on my friend Ed Iwan's gravestone, and it reads like this. Ed lived every moment. He stood in the rain, heard the thunder, danced to the lightning, and believed in rainbows. He'd want us to do the same. To stand in the rain, to dance in the lightning, to believe in the rainbows, especially this summer, and especially in times like these. I'll teach my boys about Ed and to be like him. That's what he deserves. That's what our children deserve. And that's what America's future deserves, especially in times like these. And if you've got a story to tell or a resource to share, use the hashtag Angry Americans and let me know. Don't just be angry. Be active. Like America, this show continues to be a great experiment. Definitely a work in progress. But thank you to all of you that shared your thoughts on what you think about it. I've gotten tons of great emails, tweets, and comments on all our social media. So keep them coming. And lots of suggestions for issues we could dig into. Please keep those coming as well. I'll try to review them all and tackle as many as I can in episodes to come. If you dig this show, please share it with your friends. Tell them to check out the link to angryamericans.us. Just 1 hour each week, and I promise you'll leave informed, entertained, and inspired. And check out angryamericans.us for links to our YouTube page, which has videos of my entire interview with Rachel Maddow. It's also got a video with Peter Berg, Agent Poo, Willie Geist. You can see what the Classic Car Club looks like inside. You can check out clips from our On the Street segment, which I'll have more of coming soon. And if this is your first episode, just go back and please check out the others. And big thanks to a lot of folks who helped make this episode happen. The Classic Car Club in Manhattan, again, thank you for letting us record the show there. The team at IAVA for fighting the good fight, especially on weekends like this. Eric Schonborn, Ben Stauffer, Ed Salego, and Chris Rosenthal. Big thanks to you guys for helping out with the videos, graphics, social media, and all things. Brendan Pfeiffer, Bill Schultz, Cadence 13 for the air support, Righteous Media for powering this whole enterprise, Tom Colicchio, my guest this week, for an amazing conversation, my family, my amazing wife and two boys. This will be my first Memorial Day not working, and that will be a change, but it's a change I'm excited about, knowing I'll be up in the mountains with you guys. Most of all, my deepest thanks to you for tuning in. If you dig this show, please tell your friends to check it out. Or maybe just pick three of your angriest friends. And if you're on an Apple device, please leave the show a quick 5-star review. Unless you hate the show, then please go leave Tucker Carlson's podcast a 1-star review. But also, I've been hosting on Sirius XM Radio, Channel 124, backing up my friend Chris Cuomo. You may know him from CNN. But I've been hosting his daily show, Let's Get After It, on the radio. So I want to thank him for that opportunity and thank all of you who check me out over there as well. I'll be back on the mic on Friday, June 14th, and also Friday, June 28th, maybe sooner. And hopefully Chris Cuomo will join me as a guest in the future. But that's XM Radio, Channel 124. And if you haven't checked it out yet, we've got some very cool Angry Americans t-shirts up on the Angry Americans website. They're 100% American made, which is tough to do, but they're made by veterans. They are super cool looking and comfy. They'll look awesome at your summer barbecue or your summer baseball game or for Father's Day. And every one of us knows some dude who needs a shirt that says angry on it, right? Well, check it out. And remember, it's okay to be angry and know you're not alone, especially this summer. We're all a little angry, and that's because we're paying attention. And together, we can turn that anger into positive impact, especially this summer. I'm your host, Paul Rieckhoff. Thanks for listening. Stay vigilant, America.